Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. The devil are you this Thursday? Is the sun out? Is the sky blue? The answer to that is yes, and well, certainly where I am, because we are heading into spring. That can only be a good thing, can't it, eh? So, this is episode 17, and you know how when we started this all those years back, what I wanted to try and achieve was a conversation between two people, but the spotlight on the other person, so we can get to know them. And I think, in fact, I know that this episode is a prime example of that. And it's with Rick Edwards. He's a presenter and a broadcaster on telly. If you're a certain age, you remember him from T4 and all sorts of other stuff. Right now, he is on The Wireless on BBC Radio 5 Live, co-hosting The Breakfast Show. And he came around my house and I got him a glass of water and we hit record and we discuss his rather unusual path to where he is now. And if you like this episode, go back to, I think, season 3, episode 11 with Dermot O'Leary, because there are comparisons between the two as people, as broadcasters. And I think what makes them quite brilliant broadcasters is they've got that curiosity about other people. And we discuss it in the episode about sometimes people, you know, just come up to Rick. And I mention on the episode, as with Derma, it's almost like you kind of know them. You kind of know, oh, I feel like they're kind of a mate because they've got such a natural broadcasting style. Yeah, it's a fantastic episode. I'm really, really chuffed with this. I think you'll really like Rick. He's had a lot of fun. And as you'll hear, quite naughty and mischievous. So should we get down to it? And I'll stop saying, okay. This is episode 17 of the Two Shot Podcast with the brilliant Rick Edwards. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end. Rick, how are you?
I am pretty good, I think. Yeah, it's a slightly funny time at the moment in terms of my sort of work life because
everything's slightly changed.
Yeah,
well, I mean, not slightly, it all has.
Yeah, everything's changed. I'm doing a new job on the radio, which I really like. But then the last few weeks, obviously the world has gone to shit. And so now I'm doing 3 hours a day of really bleak sort of war reporting fundamentally. Yeah. So talking to really distraught Ukrainians. And I feel quite out of my depth. And like, I know what I'm good at. I think I know what I can, but I know what my strengths are, I know what I can do. I sort of know why Five Live would have thought, oh yeah, he'd be quite good at that. I get it. And it's sort of, you know, having an interest in lots of stuff and then been a little bit funny sometimes, adding a bit of levity. And that is not what is required currently at all. And so it's tough. And it's definitely sort of affecting me quite a lot. And I'm not, I think if you're a sort of proper journalist, which again, I'm not, you're sort of prepared to some extent for this kind of eventuality. And you're able to sort of compartmentalize a bit so it doesn't just really sort of affect you outside of the job, and you're, I wouldn't say desensitized exactly, but it's something like that. And I can't do it. I get genuinely really upset when I'm speaking to people who are undergoing massive trauma, and it's maybe getting slightly better, but I don't know, like I'm finding it really, yeah,
I think I'm dealing with it
a little bit better. And even that is slightly depressing, because maybe I'm just getting a bit desensitized to it. Like you sort of, he's spoken to a lot of people having an awful time, and after a while, yeah, it just...
I suppose when you're just keeping it up for all those hours, Monday to Friday, you must be just drained at the end of it.
Yeah, very much so. And the, you know, like the getting up earlier, you know, my alarm goes off at 3:45 every morning, and that, even though I think I'm getting enough sleep, somehow you're just, your body's like, no, this isn't right. it doesn't matter you think you've had enough sleep. You're definitely going to have a sort of mild tiredness headache throughout the day. It was quite a long, answer to quite a simple question.
That's what I need. You know it yourself. There's nothing worse than a no or a yes.
Yeah.
No.
Give me, how are you? Pretty good.
Next question. Give me a bit more.
And I've given you much more.
This is great. It's all, everything. It's all good. How are you finding the move to Manchester? Did you have a connection with it anyway, or had you spent time here?
No, I mean, I have worked here a bit. I've been out here a few times. It's a great city. I didn't have any sort of particular ambition to move here, and wouldn't have done if it wasn't for the job. And I think before sort of all of this stuff that's currently going on, I felt that I was really enjoying the work, really enjoying the job, and then sort of everything, the peripheral stuff. So being in Manchester in a rental flat on my own, and keeping really antisocial hours, that was not perfect. So Ema, who you know, she's been busy, and she's still in London, and we're kind of looking for somewhere so that we can both be up here together at least some of the time. But at the moment, that's not how it's working. So fundamentally, I'm just quite lonely, I think, and not really able to do much about it, because people are like, well, let's go for a drink. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. How's 2 o'clock? And people are like, oh, no, I've got work. I've got a normal job
that I have to do. Yeah.
It's just weird. It's weird. And also, like, I'm 42. Even if I was in a position to sort of be going out and stuff, I don't know if I'm necessarily at the stage where I'm trying to go out and make new friends. That's a bit weird. And I've got like my setup at home in London's great. Like, I've got a really sort of close group of friends who I love, and like my family, and they're all there, and we all live quite close to one another. So it's all sort of, I've done all that, and now I'm sort of marooned.
I haven't got the energy to do it all again.
Yeah, I can't do it. It's that feeling of when you have a breakup, and then you're like, oh my God, I've got to go through all of the rigmarole of getting to know someone and tell the same old stories.
Get to know me. And first, has it got to be a version of me? I don't know if I can give myself to somebody.
So it's like that, but with friends. And thus far, I haven't had any opportunity to try it. And I feel like I'm not going to try it. But I suppose the good thing is that I definitely... there's no doubt in my mind, I really, really miss my wife. And
it'd be worse
if I didn't.
It'd be terrible if you just went, I'm actually really pleased after break.
Yeah,
it's really so nice not being with her all the time.
Yeah, I don't know what her take on it is. She's definitely not coming to Manchester that much, but then she has been busy. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. She did seem very excited for you when we last spoke. And she also did expect for you to talk about her love for her for at least the first 10 minutes of this podcast.
Well, I think I've done a bit of that. Actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd say you've ticked the boxes there. So yeah. she should be very happy and very secure in the knowledge.
Fantastic. Yes. Well, I can relax now.
Yeah, it's fine. Don't have a drink of water. We touched upon it a little bit. Albeit in quite a light way.
You said have a drink of water, and I just did what I was told there.
Such is the power.
Yes, I'll do that. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else you'd like?
Well, funny you should say that, kitchen's in a right old state, Rick. But we did touch upon it in the Patreons only section, and we mentioned about fame.
Yeah.
If you're not a Patreon subscriber, you can go and listen to that and enjoy.
I was doing some great stuff. Oh my God, it'd be
absolute gold.
I don't know how much he's fleecing you for, but it's worth it.
How do you deal with the certain level of fame that you're at, or when did you recognize it and you went, oh, was it back when, was it in the sort of T4 days?
Yeah, I think so. It's a strange, as you'll know, it's a strange thing to contend with. And I don't think it's hard to think about in the abstract. It's hard to imagine how you would respond or how you would feel if people started to approach you and sort of say hello and sort of act like they know you.
Mm.
Particularly, I think, when you're a presenter, because the whole thing is, I'm not playing a character. I know there isn't, because I couldn't do it. There's no artifice. It is just what you're seeing on screen or hearing on the radio. It is just me. And if you're on, so for example, T4, so you're on most weekends, then people do start to get to know you. And therefore, if they see you, then they will want to have, they'll sort of feel like it's quite natural, quite normal to have a chat. And most of the time, that's absolutely fine. And then sometimes it's sort of less so, because you just don't really feel like it, or it's just not quite the right time. And the classic is like urinals. It doesn't happen as much anymore.
Not the right time.
It just used to be amazing how many people would start chatting to you at urinals. You just sort of think, well, surely, I mean, even wait until I'm washing my hands. but
ever so slightly more acceptable.
Yeah. I think I quite quickly realised that I love my job, but the sort of being known part I didn't warm to. And I know lots of people who kind of don't mind it, really, and quite sort of embrace it. And actually, again, if you'd asked me when I was younger if I would like that, because I was an attention seeker, I think I would have said, oh, yeah, definitely. And actually, it just turns out not for me. And so I think I've probably made, I don't know if it was subconscious. No, it was probably conscious, actually, decision not to sort of curry more attention than was necessary.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't do very much press. Never really have. Sometimes you have to, but I'm not. I'd never just sort of go out and push myself without a thing that I'm being told contractually you have to do this.
Yeah.
I don't have sort of famous friends, particularly, other than people that I've worked with who then happen to be famous, or people that I was friends with from before who've ended up being famous. But I've never particularly been one for going out to sort of celeb parties and that kind of thing. I think I did do a little bit of that, and quickly realized it wasn't something that I just didn't really enjoy it very much. I'd just much rather be with my sort of actual friends.
Yeah, the real friends.
Yeah. Like the people you'd be very happy with if you were going for a one-on-one drink with. And most of the people you see at celeb parties, imagine that. Having to do a one-on-one drink with any of those people.
No, awful. I couldn't think of anything.
Awful. genuinely awful.
Yeah.
And that's not a criticism of sort of celebrities, per se. It's just like people that you don't know very well. Like, why would you want to do that?
Yeah, of course.
And with that one weird thing in common.
I've seen it before. It's just awful.
It's not the one, is it?
It's really not. I mean, I know there's very few people I know that would go across our industries who would court that type of thing, you know.
Yeah.
A percentage, and I don't really know. I wouldn't class them as friends. Most people, and I go, oh no, I couldn't think of anything worse, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a kind of there's just a slight desperation to it as well, isn't there, that you can't quite get away from. Like, you see the same old people, like those people that you see in sort of magazine articles about parties, who you look at, and with the best will in the world, you go, I don't know what it is that you've done that merits you being at that party.
Yeah.
or of any interest. And that's genuinely not like a criticism, and maybe it's more a reflection on me not being fully across the zeitgeist, but it's a weird thing. There are definitely a sort of small group of people.
And they keep cropping up.
Yeah, who keep, they're sort of everywhere. And you go, what does that, I don't know what that person does. I don't really.
No idea. But you're there.
And it's certainly, and you look, you absolutely look the part, and you look like you're having a great time, and good luck to you. but why is it happening? And I think the answer, a sort of peek behind the curtain, is you get a publicist
and you pay people to
I believe so. Yeah,
genuinely, I believe that's
years and years ago, because it felt like a thing to do. I got a publicist because lots of other people were sort of in a similar position to me had publicists.
Yeah.
And there was just a lot of that. It was just kind of them saying, oh, we've got you an invite to this party. And you sort of think, oh, this, I don't know, why am I? So, read between the lines here, I'm paying quite a lot of money to get invited to parties I don't want to go to.
And personally, I don't like parties at the best of times. I always say, and anybody that knows me knows, it's my birthday next week, right? And I just have a low-key affair, don't really do much. The worst thing you could possibly do for me is throw a surprise birthday party.
Yeah, horrible.
I would curl up. I mean, the worst. You know when the spotlight's just turned on you, you go, no, I couldn't do it. I couldn't go to somebody else's birthday party. Yeah, that's all right. It's fine. Attention's fine. Not on me.
Yeah.
But I'd be so worried that everybody wouldn't be having a good time, I wouldn't be able to relax.
Yeah. Yeah, the surprise party.
I mean, you've got to be a...
Gives me shivers.
Oh, God, did it? You've got to be a very specific type of person to go, oh, do you know what?
Thank you, everyone.
You all love me and you're
it's
here.
It's my moment.
It's form an orderly queue. No, thank you. But just going back to the fame thing and people coming up to you. You, on radio as well as telly, you've always come across as very personable and natural. And so I think sometimes with that, it's like, take for example, completely different, but Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
I think people would be quite...
Well, you're not going up to him.
You're not going to go up to him and go, how are you? Because
absolutely
his persona on stage is... Well, it's Stuart Lee, isn't it?
Yeah, Stuart Lee. It's a sort of combative, sort of disapproving, cynical...
Intellectually superior.
Yeah. You feel like whatever you say... He's going to absolutely rinse you for.
Yeah.
No chance in hell I'm going up to Stuart Lee.
But with you, because I think that's why people think, oh, yeah, there's Rick Edwards. Oh, I know him because he's just like my mate so-and-so. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's, I think that's actually a good thing.
Oh, I think it's a fantastic thing because there's nothing worse. And even before I started the podcast, whether you see it on television, but I can really hear it on the radio when people are insincere. And I do hear it a lot with broadcasters, not just when they're interviewing, when they're talking to the audience at home. And I remember hearing somebody be interviewed once, and I'm not going to say who it was, but they were laughing. And you go, you don't find that funny at all. You don't have to make that person feel that comfortable by laughing at all their shit gags.
No, and also there's a level to that. Like, obviously you're greasing the wheels a bit of an interview, but you don't have to, I don't know, that just sounds like sort of sycophancy, which is never great in an interview context. I think I'm often surprised by the number of presenters that I know who aren't really, I don't really like people, which is quite an odd, I think it's quite an odd career to go in, to go into if you don't like people, in my view.
Yeah, or you're certainly not curious about people.
Right,
I remember
right.
when I spoke to Dermot O'Leary a few years ago, and he says, you know, I'm fascinated by people. I'm curious about them. And I think that's really healthy.
Right. And that is a really great reason to be a presenter. And it's sort of why I like meeting people finding out sort of what people are like, and then lightly taking the piss out of them. That's what I enjoy. That's my comfort zone.
I didn't help matters when I opened the door on my knees, but you went in with the taking the piss straight away, and we've only just met. So yeah.
I mean, to be honest, you can't expect me not to.
No,
I mean, you're literally peering up at me from your floor.
I'll set them up. You knock them down.
But I think you have to be. Really, you don't have to be, but I think you should be interested in people, finding out what makes people tick. And that's probably my favourite part of the job is just getting to meet all sorts of people from all walks of life and sort of have a bit of fun with them.
Mm.
But there's an awful lot of people who don't have that. And then there's a few realer enigmas who are sort of, and I obviously can't and won't name any names here, but there's some presenters who I find extraordinary because they are technically very good at presenting.
Yeah.
So they absolutely do the job, can see why they've got the job, but are also weirdly, innately unlikable. and you can't, there's nothing you can do about that. You are or you aren't. And that's that. But that you are, like, the job that you've got really requires likability in a lot of cases. Not all presenters, I suppose, but most. But there's a few where you're just like, well, that is not a likable person, and yet you're doing very well.
Yep.
And you've got to say hats off to them because I don't know how you're managing it.
Well, you mentioned before about being quite an attention seeker
as a
child.
Yes. Yes.
What kind of child were you apart from an attention seeker?
That attention seeker was the kind of headline news, really. Right. So I'm an only child, and so it's sort of, it's cliche, isn't it? But so growing up, we didn't really have any money, but I was absolutely spoilt for attention by my mum and dad. And I think that then translated to when I went to school and stuff into just always wanting to be the center of attention. And I got into, I think it was a real surprise to my, to my mum and dad actually, because I was basically a really sort of good kid for them. Like I didn't really give them any grief, but I mean, every now and again, but I was basically well-behaved, nice, sort of sociable, quite sort of sweet kid. But at school, I was a nightmare. And so
in what way?
I was just naughty, and just that it all came through trying to sort of make people laugh and sort of get people to be watching me being an idiot or whatever it was. And so,
was that in the playground as well as classrooms?
Yeah. 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 I mean, I would say probably more in the classroom. I don't really, I think sort of, and the playground is just playing football.
Right, yeah.
And then, so that was sort of like, yeah, it was leisure. And then during class, it's just sort of, okay, let's see if I can make everyone laugh.
And challenge that authority within that space. I know what you mean.
I mean, I've always, apart from with my mum and dad, I've always had a sort of some sort of problem with authority. I don't really know where that comes from. Always felt the need to sort of poke it.
Sort
of rail against it. I have no idea why, but that definitely got me into trouble. So I had to leave a school because
had to leave, or you were asked to leave.
I was asked to leave.
I'm not going to dress it up. Right?
No, and that really just came from me being just giving a load of lip to teachers. And eventually they got sick of it, so off I went.
The deputy headmaster of my secondary school listens to this podcast, so he'll understand, because I was exactly the same.
Very good, yeah. Very good. Yeah. What's his name?
Richard Catmore.
Hello, Richard. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Just to let you know, I would have been a nightmare in your school. I can guarantee that. But the sort of, I suppose the interesting thing is that urge to needle authority has stayed with me, and it's not very helpful. And so I've just sort of, every now and again, I'll just do stuff, and then you kind of take a step back and just go, what have you done that for then? And it's like almost always, partly because I think it's funny, and then partly just because of this sort of, this desire to just poke. I can tell you a short, the current anecdote, which is that I've just presented a show for America for NBC, and it's this sort of reality dating show, sort of Regency era, sort of dressed up in sort of Jane Austen clobber. It's a fun show, but throughout there was a real tension between what an American, what an American sort of production company and channel want versus sort of British sensibilities.
Yeah.
So our thing is always to take the piss and sort of be funny, and that's kind of our go-to, and theirs is earnestness, like really, like very, very serious, very emotional. And so throughout the filming process, we were kind of, butting up and trying to find the compromise position.
Concerning your presenting style.
Yeah. Because, and also it's funny, like they had no idea who I was. Like they'd never sort of seen me before. They'd know what I'd done, or, they'd kind of, you go through this audition process, but you're spending very little time. They don't really know anything about you. And then they quickly realise what you're like, and they're like, less of that, please.
Dial that down.
Yeah, exactly. Stop being funny. We got there, and I think the show is the show is good, but we're still the show just started going out, and yesterday, and we're still doing voiceover, and there's still I'll do some more voiceover after this, actually. And there's still that sort of slight battle about what we can get through in the voiceover. It's a very sort of long preamble to say that the people who run the channel, who I've never, like literally like the big bosses of NBC, I guess this is indiscreet, but I think it's fine.
Don't worry, we can sort it out.
I think we'll just leave it in because it is funny. I've never met these people, but they sent an email on, so this was on Friday, just sort of a very sort of classic, sort of very earnest American, but really like a sweet email just saying, really excited about the show's premiere and thanks for all your hard work. And it's been great being, that you've put all this time, and I think people are going to love it. And then the head of the production company who made it emailed back and said, "Oh, thank you. It's amazing to collaborate with you, and thanks for all your support. And I really think the audience are going to love this show." The show had sort of various titles along the way, but it's now called The Courtship. And I emailed. And I just said, "Hold on, is it not called Jane Austen's Fuck City anymore? ?" What I'm thinking is that's very funny, and also I like the fact that they're going to have to react to this. But the kicker is nothing, absolute silence. No one has emailed back.
That's even worse.
It's gone. Oh. I haven't told my agent that because she'll go mad. But I told Ema about it. She was just like, "What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?"
I mean,
and I'm like, "Yeah, but it is funny." And she's like, "I'm not saying it's not funny. I'm saying you shouldn't have done it."
It's funny, yeah. But it's one thing. It's one thing being sarcastic in person, right? It's another thing that it translates over via a text or an email to somebody that you know, and you still worry. These are people that you don't really know.
I don't know.
I mean, the fact that they haven't got back
is superb.
It's brilliant.
It's superb.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that sort of typifies the whole experience, but also very neatly sort of sums up my, I think, my personality. So I would have, that's, if we'd had emails at school, I would have done that kind of thing. Like, that hasn't, that is a thread that is unchanging. Like, a sort of naughty, sort of giggling behind my hand sort of vibe. Terrible. Terrible, really. But we are where we are.
But so much fun.
Yeah. And I've got, this is, at some point, you have to accept that you have the personality you have. And there it is.
And people just have to deal with it.
They do. And honestly, I think most people like it. And then some people don't, you know.
Have you ever had to dial things down being on Five Live now?
Yeah. I mean, just you have to sort of navigate the tone much more carefully.
Yeah.
Because it demands that. But I kind of like that. I think it's quite a good exercise. And I definitely, like, I enjoy the stuff that isn't in any way sort of amusing. Like, I don't just sort of sit there thinking, oh, yeah, when are we going to get to a thing that we can have some fun with?
Yeah.
But it's more of a challenge, I think, because it's all over the place. And that's the beauty of it. But it does mean that you do have to think about gear changes and stuff quite a lot. And there's certain, I think I've definitely made a couple of errors probably in the 4 months that I've done it. Sometimes just even little things, like I've always wanted to try and communicate and present in using the words that I would just use if I was just talking to anyone anyway. Like I don't enjoy sort of very formal language. I don't enjoy stuff that feels very written. Just never have. I always sort of try and just say it like you would say it if you're out and about. And I think occasionally that can feel a bit too casual. Occasionally for the channel, and we've kind of spoken about that, and I get it. So that I think I need to slightly tweak, like, and also it's so it's quite relaxed, and Rachel, my co-host, is brilliant, and we do have a bit of a laugh sometimes, and sometimes when I am having a laugh, I get carried away. that's the sort of truth of it, and I'll you know, call someone a tool, and then and they'll be like, well, no, don't
probably best not.
Don't, but not that. We like it, Rick, but not that.
How do you find the balance of a co-host on the radio compared to sort of co-hosting on TV?
I think it's more fun on radio because, and maybe this is just the, maybe this is just the show itself, but you're spending a lot of time with that person, and none of the stuff that you're, so, you know, obviously the team are amazing and they're, you know, producing the show and putting together loose scripts for stuff. But the stuff where you're just chatting is entirely organic and entirely unscripted. And it's really nice. And that doesn't happen so much on TV. Like, everything is much more, it's kind of what the best thing about radio actually is that you get to just sort of make stuff up on the spot, and you don't rehearse anything. Like, I'm quite easily bored, and rehearsing, like, I just, it like, as soon, if I have to rehearse a joke, for example, for TV, I find it hard to then do it again and still.
Well, that's really difficult because it ceases to become funny.
Yeah. But then, you know, comedians do it the whole time. Although I, in my absolute ignorance, so when I was younger, I did a bit of stand-up. I started out doing stand-up when I was at university.
I was going to ask you about that because I don't know how I knew, or I was just taking a punt that you may have done that.
Yeah.
Early on.
That was actually the thing that was best for me at university, coming out of school and there being a legitimate outlet for me to try and make people laugh rather than disrupt your classroom. And that was genuinely, I think, really, yeah, helped me a lot. But when I was doing it at university, you sort of, I didn't do loads of it, but when you did do it, it was kind of quite a similar crowd who would come in to these nights. It was like Tuesday nights or something.
Yeah.
And so you just do new stuff every time because the people would have heard you. And it never really occurred to me. I'd not seen enough. I'd watched stand-up. I'd been to see live, like, professional comedians, but I don't think I'd seen anyone more than once, or if I had, not the same tour. I honestly hadn't realised that people just did the same set again and again. So when I came to London, and I was sort of on the open mic circuit, it was an absolute... I couldn't figure it out. You'd go somewhere, you'd be like, no, I've seen you do all this stuff. But that's obviously how you... I mean, very obviously, when you think about it, that's how you get better. That's how you hone your material. But I hadn't... I hadn't sort of gauged that. And I just was not... I found that quite tricky. That's not that I ended up, by no means is that the only reason I didn't become a stand-up comedian. Like, I had several... So when I was starting out, I did a double act with Joe Wilkinson and knew Diane Morgan really well, and they were both just bad. Like, it's interesting. I was fine. I was good enough. But they were clearly better. And it's interesting, that sort of thing. We're just like, well, these people will do very well, yeah. and rightly so. And could I have made a career? I don't know, really. But I was never going to be as... I couldn't see how I'd ever be as good as them. Equally with Joe, who I spent more time with, he really worked at it. Like, he'd be doing sort of... You know, he was still working. He was a graphic designer back then. An ad agency, I think. And he was still doing sort of 4 or 5 gigs a week and really... just really working at the craft, which is what you have to do. And if I did 2 gigs in a week, I'd be feeling very pleased with myself. it's really motoring. And so that was the other thing. I could sort of, probably when we first started out, there was maybe less. I still think Joe and Diane were better, but like there was less to choose between us. And as time went on, they were just getting. I could just see them getting much better than me,
yeah.
And me not really getting very much better.
So what was the plan at university?
Didn't have one. Really didn't have one. I don't even know if I wanted to go to university. It's odd. I knew that my parents would be really pleased if I went to university. You know, they'd be really proud. And like they hadn't been to uni or anything, and only one person in my family had been to uni before me, and so it was quite a big, it felt like a big deal. And then I wanted to go to Bristol, actually, which is where most of my friends were going. But I also sort of knew that I had an outside chance at least of getting into Cambridge. And I thought that, it's probably churlish not to try. And so I applied and I got in. And so I went there, which it was it's a funny place. I really didn't like it at first because I'd sort of everything that I'd feared it might be, it was.
Right. Okay.
And worse. And I was doing maths, essentially because I was quite lazy, always quite lazy, and but I was just good at maths and science, and also they required the least work for if you could do them at least, and I could, or at least I was good at exams. That's actually the truth of it. I don't think I was never academic. It would be wrong to, even though if you sort of looked at my academic career, you go, well, you must have been. Very academic. No, I know lots of people who are very academic. They're not me. I was just a guy who was good at exams. And sort of good,
but it must have come. Did it come easy to you?
Yeah, it did. It did. Right. But then it very. I think the thing with, I don't know, I mean, it's amazing that I did it to myself. But the Cambridge maths degree is very highly regarded because it's the hardest maths degree you can do, yeah. Literally anywhere in the world, and it was. I mean, it was just so, I cannot overemphasize how hard it was. And I'd never really, and so it went from always finding maths easy to suddenly just being like, what the fuck? I can't do this. On top of the people who do maths at Cambridge, they're an interesting
particular.
Particular is a good word. They're particular crew, and
didn't fit in. Rick.
I didn't really fit in particularly well, but it wasn't like it wasn't the sort of thing where I was like, I'm too cool for these guys. It was very much they didn't want anything to do with me. Like it wasn't a sort of me stepping away.
Yeah.
Them saying, well, no, we're not. You know, you're not really one of us. So that was great. And so I changed subjects after a year. So I stuck it out for a year and then was just like, I don't know, I can handle it.
What did you change?
I changed to science, right, to a science degree, which is more enjoyable. But I didn't, even at university, they quite often spoke about kicking me out. Actually, this was for laziness. This was for not going to lectures and not going to the sort of one-on-one supervisions and stuff. But I feel like if I went to university now, I'd absolutely love it. I'd really, and I'd work hard and I'd do all my reading and it would be
a joy.
It'd be such a joy.
Yeah.
Like if there was a way to the extent that me and Emer have spoken about it, I've said like I would at some point really love to do that. And she's like, well, when are you? I mean, you're mad. You're not going to do that. And she's probably right. But at that time, and I think this is true of lots of people, I just didn't want to work. I wanted to, you know, like hang out with my friends and sort of, you know, go out and get pissed and stuff and
make people laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed that. And I didn't want to go to my lectures. And I can remember having a conversation with a senior fellow. I don't know what they're called. They've got a name. Dean? Was he the dean? He might have been. Anyway, where I tried to sort of explain that. And he just looked at me like I'd lost my mind. I just said, the thing is, like, I don't, like, obviously I'm here and I'll try and, you know, not fail my exams.
But in an ideal world.
Yeah, but I'm not like, I just don't really, I don't want to go to lectures and stuff. And that is not something that goes down well in this sort of pressure cooker academic environment of a university like
only
that.
Only but imagine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very, I thought, honesty is the best policy. It was not the best policy.
Not at all. So did you manage to complete?
I did. And in one of the, an absolute travesty is I got a 2-1. So like a respectable degree. And I've got lots of friends who also got 2-1s who sort of worked for 3 years or 4 years or whatever, really. And it genuinely fucked some of my friends off, I think. And rightly so.
Yeah.
Like, listen, I have to hold my hands up and say, yes, that is a disgrace. Like,
Edward swans through three or four years and comes out with a 2-1.
Yeah, it's terrible. And tells you that the exam system is flawed. Because it shouldn't be possible that someone like me
can
get through and get the same, you know, everyone forgets, you know, in the end, no one cares about all of that. You just look, well, actually no one cares, as in no one ever thinks about it once you leave university, which is a good thing to know. But if anyone did, they're just going to think, oh, that's quite good. You did quite well. And I really didn't. It was undeserved, thoroughly undeserved.
So what was the next step then after university? I'm trying to get to, because I don't hear any, my son, who's 10, said to me the other day, I think I've got a top three of things that I want to do when I'm older. I said, you've got plenty of time.
Yeah.
I mean, they all revolved around Japan and anime and things like that, because that's what he's into at the moment, and that's fine.
Yeah, that's good, yeah, yeah, yeah. But is he drawing a bit of manga?
He started.
Nice.
Dying to go to Japan. Nice. But he needs to just broaden his palate with his taste, because,
yeah,
you know, it's...
You've got to go in there with an open palate.
Yes.
I mean, I love it.
Yeah.
And the food's fantastic, but there's some stuff that is, you know, testing.
Whether I would have liked all that at 10 years old is another matter. Probably really? Not.
I think I would have given it a go, I reckon, but it's hard to know. I mean, there was some stuff where me and Emma went on our honeymoon to Japan and had a fantastic time and ate some incredible food. But sometimes when you go and stay in a ryokan, so one of the sort of traditional inns,
yeah,
you don't get to choose what you're eating. They bring you the meal. So you sat there on your tatami mats and they come in. And also they sort of stand there and watch you while you eat. And some of the stuff
is a challenge.
Is a real challenge. And I was having to eat double of some of these things subtly. I just remember there was this absolutely vast oyster. I like oysters. Mm. I don't want a huge oyster. And I don't want it sort of shallow fried, but that's what it was. And so I managed to get one down, and then Amy sort of slid hers over. And I'm just looking at this thing, going, "My good lord!" Yeah. So yeah, your son's going to have to,
step in,
prepare himself for that. But top three. I genuinely had no idea what I wanted to do. I think when I was younger, I thought I'd quite like to be a vet because I like animals. I thought I'd quite like to be a stuntman because I really liked The Fall Guy with Lee Majors. I thought at one point I quite wanted to be an architect, but I did work experience as an architect. It's quite funny, a council architect's office, because that was the best thing that my school could arrange. And it was so boring. And I think this is a very good observation. Yes, some architects get to do incredible projects that are sort of mind-blowing and beautiful and iconic, but the majority of architects are going to be doing some really humdrum stuff that it is quite tedious and sort of paint by numbers. And that's the case with the council architects, where they're sort of just designing sort of planting areas for Marks and Spencers or whatever.
Well, ironically, architect was one of his top three, but it was very specific. It was an architect of futuristic hotels in Japan. There's a link. That sounds interesting.
And that would be superb, of course. But pragmatically, that might not be where he ends up.
Yeah, exactly.
You do have to, because of his first 6 years.
Look.
6 years of that. To potentially be, sort of designing, I don't know, like a drive-through McDonald's or something.
Oh, dear.
I know.
Bleak.
Not for me.
But saying that, you said at that time, what were you, like 21, 22?
Yeah. And I, literally no clue what I might want to do. I'd enjoyed doing the stand-up and sort of sketches and stuff. Sort of had a vague idea that maybe performing in some way would be a good... good route.
Were you doing any footlights?
Did a little bit of footlights. Yeah. Never like the tour shows or anything. Like lots of my friends who I'm still friends with now, they did much more of it, and went up to Edinburgh and stuff. But I couldn't. I've never been able to act. And that's sort of quite a key bit. Of doing those shows. you got to accept that about yourself. I'm good at being myself, and I'm definitely good at that. But anything else is beyond me. My very, very limited range indeed.
Know your limitations. Yes. Someone said to me years ago, when in my early 20s, when I was starting to act, know your limitations, because it's a strength.
And it's right. My career, and yours as well. There's no point me doing auditions for things every now and again that have done them in the past, and every time I just thought, this is a waste of everyone's time. I'm not going to get this part. I shouldn't get this part because I cannot do it.
And if I do, something's gone wrong.
Or if I do, it's because the only times I've ever acted in anything, I've always been playing a version of myself.
Absolutely.
But literally a version of myself, as in a character called Rick Edwards, and then I'm okay. But even then, a long time ago, me and one of my best friends made a sitcom pilot for Channel 4 that actually I think was quite good. you know, we were happy with it. And it was a sort of fictitious version of me. And we genuinely had a discussion about who we thought should play me, because we both were like, it probably shouldn't be you. And in the end, it was me. And I you know, I made a decent fist of it, but not, yeah. The fact that we were honestly thinking, okay, who can we get? Who would be good at this? Because
6 foot
can rule out you.
Yeah, you're out.
You're obviously out. And also the other thing, I'd always really watched a lot of TV with my mum and dad. We always liked TV, but then we just never, it sort of sounds dumb to say it. I just hadn't considered that it was a job, that people that like were making TV was a job that was in any way possible for someone like me. Like, we just didn't know. I'd never met anyone who worked in the media.
No, I don't think it sounds dumb at all, because I've spoken to actors on this podcast as well, and they've said when they were growing up, they didn't even realise that that would be a viable career.
You don't know, do you?
No, you don't.
Especially if you don't have any sort of familial connections, or, you know, or like your friends' parents do. Like, that kind of stuff's quite important. That kind of sphere of opportunity is quite interesting, and it just happened. Like my parents have been always incredibly supportive of everything I've ever done, and pretty much said you can do whatever you like. It's just that they wouldn't have, I don't know, we just weren't aware that, you know, being a comedian, being a TV presenter, working in TV production, any of this, it was nowhere near anything I'd ever thought of. And then I guess when I was in my last year at university, I was doing a bit of, painful to talk about, but I was doing a bit of modelling. We don't need to go into that.
Okay.
It was awful. But
we'll do that for Patreon special.
Yeah.
Was that do we have to go into it? Is that comfortable? Because
no, horrible. And actually, it's made it so that I don't think before I started doing that, I minded having my photo taken at all. Like, I don't think I had any view on it. I'm just like, fine. And now I don't like having my photo taken. I'm pretty sure it's from modelling. It's like, it's a grim industry. I really didn't like it. I've found it sort of quite depressing, actually. Sort of upsetting at times as well. Like, they're genuinely mean to you. I'm sort of just saying things like, "You got your face is too fat. You're drinking too much beer." And you're like, "I'm 21. Like,
oh, leave
it. Of course, I'm drinking a beer. Also, I know I don't have a fat face. I'm just not unbelievably drawn."
Yeah, don't give me a complex.
Yeah. But anyway, they through that, they said that T4 were doing sort of open auditions. And this would have been to replace Dermot, actually.
Right.
And I was just like, oh yeah, I'll go and give that a go, having never thought anything about presenting. The audition process went quite well. I got down to the last two. Weirdly, me and Colin Murray, who are now both on Five Live.
Yep.
For various reasons, neither of us got it, and they gave the job to Vernon. Fine, but that sort of sowed the seed in my mind of like, oh, that was quite fun. Like, the, you know, I did sort of 2 weeks kind of shadowing the presenters and stuff, and and I think then I was like, okay, that could be an option,
right?
It's kind of came out of that. And then weirdly, when I finished university, or actually in my last year, I started tutoring. I was doing like one-on-one sort of private tutoring, basically for rich kids, in maths and science. And I ended up tutoring Ruby Wax's kids.
Right.
One evening, I was sat after tutoring her son, sat at her kitchen table, and we sort of got on quite well, and she just said, what are you doing with your life? And I was like, I don't know. And I sort of casually said, I was sort of vaguely thinking about television. And she said, have you applied for any graduate trainee schemes? And I was like, no. And Waterpoint didn't even know they existed because I'd never properly sort of, it wasn't a sort of properly formed idea. But I went away and looked up graduate trainee schemes, applied for one and got on it. And so I was like a junior researcher and did that for a year or so and did a bit of freelance development after that. But also they got me to do a bit of on-screen stuff because they'd used me to do some audience warm-up for a studio show and that went quite well. And so then there's lots of other detail in there, but basically I started working in TV and then people sort of said, oh yeah, maybe you could do on-screen stuff. And then eventually I got a job doing music stuff on E4 sort of permanently. But there's never been any great plan and arguably still isn't. It's just sort of, you just sort of drift from one thing to another. And
I think you're always in danger if there is a plan.
Well, yeah, because then something can go wrong. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually I can look back over my career, which is eccentric, I would say, in terms of the sort of different stuff that I've done. But I can't look back and say, well, that went wrong because there was nothing to go wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like I was taking things as they came and making decisions sort
and
of in
learning
in,
on the job.
In the moment. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Were there any time like a producer said, we want you to kind of change your style or change who you are? Because I have a friend of mine who says, oh, I can't listen to you on your podcast. And I said, thank you very much.
Thank you
for being so supportive.
Yeah.
Because she went, it's hard for me because it's you, but it's like a version of you. Not necessarily probably in this bit, so if I'm doing an intro to whoever's listening.
Yeah.
Did that make sense?
Yeah. This American show is probably the closest.
Changing style?
Yeah, where they're lit, all of the stuff that I just naturally want to do, which is sort of ad lib and be funny, that I feel is what I'm good at, they were certainly initially quite resistant to. It was interesting. And then I think, very early on, actually, when I was... when I was a junior researcher on the graduate trainee scheme, the head of talent at that production company said, I don't think you've got what it takes. So I would focus on, behind the camera, which, and she would definitely not remember saying that, which is quite funny. And she's now very high up at a channel. It still makes me laugh a little bit. But I actually feel like it was probably quite a good motivator because I thought, oh, I think you're wrong. I think I can do this.
Did that spur you on?
I don't, not like...
I'm going to show you.
Not that, but it did... I just made me think it's probably quite important not to listen to anyone too much. Just get on with trying to do your best and keep sort of hustling and see what happens. That's just because the opinion of one person.
Oh,
if it's loads of people saying, like I always, I was doing stand up. Yeah. When I was quite young, me and Joe would really, it would really make us laugh. The people that you'd see on the open mic circuit who were absolutely risibly bad, like just like awful, like just couldn't do it. Weren't funny people. If you spoke to them, they weren't funny. It's not like they were sort of funny people that couldn't do it on stage. Just not very odd. And we're always like, how is no one saying to them? Like, surely somebody, like one of their friends, just go, I don't think it's...
Look, I know you've got a dream and everything.
Yeah, but you've given it a decent go. And now it's time to, stop that. I never felt like that was happening. I felt there was enough people sort of who were quite encouraging. But I mean, it's a lottery. I think that I talked to Reema about this quite a lot, that acting, I would hate to be an actor. Not only, let's assume that I could act. Forget that for a moment. Because I can't, like, the rejection, the constant, because that's so much of the job. Mm. Even for successful actors who work a lot, there's like a, there's a fraction of a percent of actors who don't have to worry about the next job. Like, and it's so small. And even the ones that you look at, so, you know, like, well, actually, yeah, you, Ema, people you're like, oh yeah, I know these people. You're just going up for auditions and either getting told no or just never hearing back.
Yeah.
Constantly. Mm. And that's a part of the job that people don't see. And it's really, I think, just like emotionally damaging. Like it makes me feel really anxious when Ema's going up for stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you, I genuinely don't know how you deal with it. And the thing with presenting is that once, I think probably, the just sort of in terms of numbers, the first break, your first sort of foot in the door is probably harder because there's so few gigs. I mean, maybe that's not true so much anymore because there are more outlets, but I think still, like, there's not that many working presenters. If you look at how many working actors there are, they're just not the jobs. But crucially, once you're in, if you're half decent, there's work. And of course, there'll be periods where there's a bit of a lull, but fundamentally, you probably are going to be okay.
And it's a much smaller pool.
It's such a small pool.
You see the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, all the time.
Yeah, I sort of think, well, who are my competitors for jobs? And there's probably like 10 people, if that.
Yeah.
Really. If they're sort of, I mean, sometimes maybe even more because they haven't decided whether they, you know, what they want. Like, literally, don't know if it's, we want a man or a woman, or we don't know if blah. But it's not very many people who do the job, and people know can do the job. And obviously, there is a shit ton of actors, and that's just how it is.
Yeah. Someone asked me the other day during an interview, they went, have you never thought about going over to America? I went, well, no. Why would I do that? There's loads more actors out there.
Yeah.
They don't know me. I'll be getting that 20-odd years of building my career here and throwing it in the bin and starting from scratch. Why on earth would I want to do that?
Yeah, that's exactly the... About 10 years ago, I think, I was... in LA, I think, for work, but for British TV.
Yeah.
And I just met some agents because my agent here said it would be a good idea. And the thing that I came away from it, firstly, it's weird, like Americans are quite sort of full on. And secondly, I was like, oh my God, I'd have to start from scratch again. I don't want to do that.
And also, most of them,
exhausting,
as we know, don't get sarcasm anyway.
No.
So
it's got to be a fucking struggle.
You know that strength that you've got, Rick?
Yeah.
That's
you're going to have to get rid of that.
Yeah, get rid of that. Yeah.
You know your personality. We'd love to, to do a bit of work on that. And it's funny that sort of through no design or intention, I'm now doing a show in America. And who knows, you know, whether that'll lead anywhere. But at least it's sort of, if it did, I would have done something. And so you're not quite starting from scratch. But it's exhausting, the thought of starting again. It doesn't...
No. I've always said, if there's a calling card, if there's something that takes me there,
exactly,
because the steps of the career of the job,
yeah,
and it's a natural... I'm not going to say progression because I don't think it's progressive, but it's just different.
Yeah.
Then I would.
Yeah.
I would think about it. But I was just reading something the other week and then I went, oh no, this is 18 weeks in Australia. I can't go to Australia for 18 weeks. I've got a boy. I'm going to miss life. I can't do that. You've got to balance, work life.
I'll let you into a small sort of personal joke, which is that me and all my friends call penises, boys. So when you say, I can't go to Australia for 18 weeks, I've got a boy. There's internally, I'm smirking.
And external. I'll just, I can't go to Australia for 18 weeks, right? Because I have a son.
Yes.
Better?
Yeah, much yep. better. Okay, much better. I'm still thinking about your boy.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I can't leave the podcast there because everybody is just thinking of you thinking about my penis. Were you always very natural, not natural, relaxed in front of a camera?
I think not. I'd be interested. Was I?
What, to go back and look at those
early
tapes?
I was about to say, yeah, would I actually? I don't know. Yes, possibly. I don't like watching myself. I've never liked watching myself. And I know that people say you have to watch yourself because that's how you get better. And
I'm not sure. But I'm sure it meant possibly in your line of work. I don't know.
Maybe. I'm not sure.
But the same people say in my line of work, oh, yeah, I go back and I watch.
It's agonising though, isn't it?
Well, I just see all the cracks.
Yeah. No. Oh, he's doing it. He's trying to remember his line.
Oh, he's pulling that out. He's pulling that old trope out, is he? But also I get slightly... You know, about the lack of control that sort of I have in my business. I get a bit miffed when they've possibly used a certain take or they've got cut to a different angle. I've gone, oh, no, well, why have you done that? I wouldn't like to, not saying that I want to direct, but I would have obviously done that differently.
That doesn't
sit right with me.
That, I think, is probably quite universal with actors. I know Ema says that, and particularly on the show that she's just done, The Curse, where there's a lot of ad-libbing and a lot of it improvising. And then obviously not very much of it can make it in because of the time constraints.
No.
And that, I think, can be quite frustrating. And you'll always remember, oh, I definitely said a really funny thing, or I definitely did that better. But what you always have to remind yourself is literally no one else knows that. So they're just watching it and enjoying it.
Yeah.
They're not thinking, I wonder if she could have delivered that a bit better. It's a fool's game, isn't it? But what you want to do, therefore, is not watch yourself.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly for me. But I went to see my goddaughter on stage at university in a play on...
Me and my friends call our balls goddaughters.
Ah, brilliant. Great. Yeah. There you go. We're just going to work around.
Imagine if we did.
Work around to the back. If you did, I suggest group therapy with your friends. But she came off...
Goddaughters are a bit sore, actually. I don't know.
I can't finish this story now.
You can, but you're going to forget what I said.
She came off stage and we were just congratulating and she was fantastic. But she went, oh no, because I messed up this and I missed out that. And I went, we don't know. That's the first time we've seen it. You've done it for the last few weeks and you've been rehearsing it. You know, but we don't.
Yeah.
So you just get away with it. It's totally fine.
Yeah, it's true. But it's quite a hard thing to remind yourself of, isn't it?
Yeah. Are you critical on yourself?
To sort of up to a point, because...
like if you want to do another take of something and they go, we haven't got time, we've got to move on, would you put your foot down?
Not really, actually. No, I'm quite... I quite like someone else sort of taking control and sort of saying that was good.
Yeah,
no, that was you know. I prefer that, I think. Also I don't like doing stuff multiple times anyway.
So, we already know you're lazy.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm quite a lazy man. So if I think I've done it passably, in it goes.
It'll do.
Yeah. No one will know I could do that better. They've never seen me do it better. So yeah, no, I can sort of, where again, in stark contrast to Ema, who is a perfectionist. But that's why... You know, being brutally honest, that is why she will be way more, one of the reasons she will be way more successful than me, because she has a sort of a drive and a vision and a kind of, perfectionism and a kind of she's quite controlling, but in a good way. And she just cares so much, and you can see it in her in her work, I think. And I watch her ITV, the crime drama that she's done, and she's been across like everything in a way that I just never would be. I'd be like, no, I think that's probably fine. And she'll be, really like finessing every single detail. Like she's on top of the music. She's on top of like putting the title sequence together. She's on top of the font. She's on top of the, like she just, she's fastidious and brilliant. And I am sort of quite, sort of sloppy and like all right, but I think that makes us a good team, because you don't want to have two people who are brilliant
and really competitive.
No, you don't want that. You don't want that at all. So I'm very happy that I just sort of I'll sit back and watch her sort of win loads of awards, and that'd be great.
Well, we started out our conversation talking about your good wife, and we've just ended it talking about it. So I reckon she should be very, very happy.
She'll be thrilled. Also, I've just been saying how great she is. So yeah, job done.
Rick Edwards, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you?
It's good one, right?
Yeah, he's a good guy. I really like that episode. I hope you did, and thank you for downloading and subscribing. The Patreon only special on this episode is an absolute belter. It's everything what you would want. So if you do support us on Patreon, get over there now and you'll hear extra stuff with myself and Rick. It's not the usual questions. I do try and change what we do on the Patreon each week. And this is perfect. If you want to support us, then go to twoshotpod@patreon.com and find out what you want to do. I mean, as little or as lot, that's not even a sentence, as what you can afford to support the free podcast that we give you week in, week out. This is season 9, episode 17. So that means what? What does that mean, Craig? It means we've only got 3 more episodes to go until the end of season 9. And let me tell you what we're going to do after that. We are going to have a little break, okay? Are we going to be stopping recording? No, we're going to start recording season 10. Because you know what we've changed? It's blocks of 20 episodes. Are we going to be resting on our laurels, twiddling our thumbs, just hitting record to people? No, we're going to do much, much more. There's some exciting new things coming for season 10. You're going to see and hear a few changes, all changes for the best. Trust me. We're going to be doing live shows at Latitude Festival in the summer. If you come to Latitude, come to the podcast tent and say hello. It'll be lovely to see you. And we are going to try and book in some live shows this year. We are just sorting that out. So hopefully we'll see a few of you when we're on the road for a bit. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? So until next week, thank you so much for downloading, sharing, subscribing, popping onto the socials and saying hello, spreading the word. It means a lot. Word of mouth is key, remember? Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.